Yes, we felt like Leonard, he'd have some options, but...
Well, whenever you're good to go.
He doesn't seem like a Leonard to me.
Okay. And it's a public hearing, so you don't have to worry about a forum at this point.
He'll be a Leo to us.
We're ready, whenever you...
The Women's Caucus is ready, we can start.
Yeah, we are ready.
Lion.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is the appointed time, so we will call to order the... meeting of the House Healthcare Committee for May 23rd, 2011. Pleased to see all of you here today.
Yeah.
Oh, here he is.
Yeah, come on. Right now. Sorry.
We were waiting for you.
Yeah. I'm especially pleased to see Representative Clem, since we were looking for him. And here he is. So first off, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 89A. And I will call Representative Clem.
And John Powell.
And John Powell.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem. I actually don't even know what's in the original bill, so I'm not here to testify on the contents of current 89.
That'll shorten things up, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a wonderful bill. We've got the dash five amendments. This is Regents with me, and these are... series of notification type reforms that would help avoid unfortunate circumstances where people end up being canceled and aren't aware of it, we believe. And I could let John speak to the contents if you want to know the contents, but they involve some specially marked envelopes, and if you get a refund, a letter explaining why you got the refund and making sure the person is actually dead and things like that.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon in support of the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 89. As the representative just pointed out, the Dash 5 amendments add notices to make sure in all cases appropriate notices on enrollment and related coverage changes are sent. Also, it adds an explanation must be sent with every refund. And that was one of the crucial problems in the situation that Representative Clem brought to you, that an explanation was not included with a refund. It does leave out the details on death-related notices other than we are to confirm them in order to provide sensitivity to those people who receive them. For those of us who've gone through a death of a family member, it is somewhat disconcerting sometimes to receive certain kind of almost, if you find a better term, I can't, bureaucratic language. So it leaves that to more sensitive language. And at Regents, we have begun to implement all of these without legislation and would do so even if a bill doesn't pass. But we strongly urge you to adopt the Dash A5 amendments.
Any questions of these two?
Are there any issues in the underlying bill that we need to comment on?
Mr. Co-Chairs, it's my understanding that they're still working on it. So there may even be an additional amendment or two for the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I believe Mr. Behrens is here to fill us in on the A6 amendments.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst at the State of Oregon Insurance Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I can limit my testimony to the A6 amendments if you'd like. This bill's been said over a couple of times, so I haven't actually gotten to talk about the bill in its entirety. I'm happy to do that, whatever the committee would like me to do.
You have things you'd like to tell us about the bill? This might be a good time.
Okay.
We're going to set it over about 9 more times, and we have to vote on it. So.
Okay. Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, I'm here today to talk about Senate Bill 89A, which makes the statutory changes necessary to remove impermissible inconsistencies between Oregon law and the Affordable Care Act, the federal health care reform bill the President signed into law on March 23, 2010. Passage of Senate Bill 89 will benefit consumers and businesses alike because it will ensure consistency in regulatory guidance, statutory standards, and terminology between the state and federal laws. The Affordable Care Act preempts state law, so if a state law is inconsistent with the Act in a way that is less protective, the federal government will enforce federal law. As we developed this legislation, our approach was to focus on provisions of the Affordable Care Act that are effective prior to 2014 to make changes to Oregon's law without incorporating every provision of the federal law into the Oregon Insurance Code, and to ensure that Oregon law does not impermissibly conflict with the Affordable Care Act. I will walk through some of the more significant changes that Senate Bill 89A makes to existing Oregon law. The legislation modifies the definition of health benefit plan, which is essentially major medical coverage, the type of coverage to which the Affordable Care Act applies, to make it more consistent with the federal definition of health insurance coverage. The bill requires new health benefit plans to include coverage of preventive services without cost sharing, such as co-payments, co-insurance, and deductibles. The bill prohibits new individual plans from denying coverage to children based on pre-existing health conditions. It prohibits insurers from imposing lifetime limits on essential health benefits and phases out annual dollar limits on essential benefits in group and new individual plans. It requires insurers to provide coverage to dependent children up to the age of 26, and it modifies Oregon's definition of emergency services and our emergency services mandate to be consistent with the Affordable Care Act to ensure that out-of-network emergency services are covered at essentially the same rate as in-network emergency services. It adds protections for consumers who appeal decisions made by insurance companies. It gives the department the ability to enforce the Affordable Care Act to ensure Oregonians receive the full benefit of the law. And it prohibits insurers from rescinding, canceling, or non-renewing health benefit plans absent fraud or intentional misrepresentation of material fact. It also ensures that coverage is not rescinded for fraudulent acts or intentional misrepresentations of insurance agents. It requires insurers to notify a person losing coverage because of a rescission at least 30 days in advance, and it would also require insurers to notify the department as well of rescissions. While this is not a requirement of the federal law, this reporting provision will allow the department to better track rescissions in the marketplace and to ensure compliance with the new rescission requirements. The Affordable Care Act limits the new rescission requirements to health benefit plan coverage, and Senate Bill 89, however, extends the new rescission requirements to all insurance policies, including accident-only and specific disease, and I should clarify, all health insurance policies. Although not required by the federal law, we believe this extension will provide additional protection to Oregon consumers. Finally, Senate Bill 89A proposes to limit the health insurance eliminate the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee, or as we call it, HIRAC, because HIRAC's statutory duties, which include designing the basic plan, portability coverage, and the standard health statement, will no longer exist. I assure you, however, that the elimination of HIRAC will not in any way impact the department's strong commitment to stakeholder input or involvement in any way. These are the more significant changes that Senate Bill 89A would make to Oregon law. We have been working diligently to implement the Affordable Care Act, and we believe that the passage of this legislation provides important consumer protections and will eliminate impermissible conflicts with federal law. And to address the A6 amendments and potentially other amendments, we have requested some amendments to tighten up the language of the bill and to make further changes based on additional guidance that we have received, and the A6 amendments have been requested by the department. And essentially what they do is add a consumer protection provision to the bill that was formerly found in Senate Bill 87. These protections will help Oregonians who lose their job to maintain their group health insurance, and we would appreciate the committee including these provisions in Senate Bill 89. The A6 amendments expand and improve Oregon state continuation law. They help to ensure that more Oregonians and their families can take advantage of continued group coverage after an employee loses his or her job. Specifically, they would allow spouses and dependents of an affected employee to independently elect state continuation coverage even when the employee is ineligible. These amendments clarify Oregon law to ensure that Oregonians who lose group coverage because of a reduction in hours are eligible for state continuation, and they provide better notice to Oregonians who are eligible for the coverage. I do appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about the legislation.
Questions?
Are there more amendments coming?
There should be, as far as the department knows about, we have one more set of amendments, Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, that are the more technical changes to the bill. And I believe there's also a separate amendment that deals with ORS 743A141, which is the hearing aid mandate that Representative Cannon worked on. There is an issue with the existing law as it relates to the dependent coverage. Under federal law, a mandate cannot vary coverage based on the age of a dependent. So we've suggested that there be some changes made to that particular statute.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the department's been in touch with me about this. I support the change that they are making. I believe it is a necessary one in order to comply with, in order for our statute to be consistent with federal law.
In the event, I ask this of most federal, most of our legislation that correlates to federal legislation, in the event the Affordable Care Act is overturned, where does that leave us with this bill?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlee, if the Affordable Care Act is overturned, one of the things that we have worked hard to do is not put the provisions of federal law into Oregon law. So the federal law that was overturned would not be applied. However, those provisions that were changed in Oregon law would still be applicable. However, I think for the most part, those provisions that I outlined are good for Oregonians.
Thank you. What a lively group today. Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Would anyone else play? No? Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 89. Probably not be the last word on that bill.
We need to carry it over.
It is already scheduled for Wednesday.
We have it ready to go in.
It is scheduled for Wednesday, and then if we don't have the documentation, then the committee can carry over.
Yes, I would advise everyone to keep looking at the schedules. It will reappear. So, Wednesday next. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 579A. And we have Barbara Glidewell and Janet Billups. Brian, do you want to come up at the same time? State your name and begin.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee and Thompson. I am Barbara Glidewell, for the record. I have been the OHSU Ombudsman for nearly 35 years. In that capacity, an ombudsman is there for the people. That person is responsible to represent the patient's voice and advocate for their best interests, particularly if they are having difficulty in communication or there is some sort of conflict that arises. So the reason that I'm here today is to explain the rationale for Senate Bill 579. Oregon hospitals admit patients, as you know, day after day. These patients are able to make their health care decisions successfully, including patients who have developmental disabilities, including patients who have chronic disease and patients who are extremely sick. Most people can speak for themselves. However, this bill addresses the too often situation when a patient enters the hospital with no family or no friends. The term is called unbefriended, and for some reason at that time lacks capacity to consent to medically necessary treatment. It authorizes an Oregon hospital to appoint a healthcare provider or a multidisciplinary team within the hospital to serve as a designee on behalf of the unbefriended, incapacitated patient who requires expedited procedures. Now, often patients enter in the trauma system, and we have statutory regulations for managing trauma. And throughout a trauma resuscitation, the patient remains on trauma service. But ultimately, the patients generally go off a trauma service onto a medicine service, an orthopedic service, or neurology service. There, they are no longer under the trauma statutory regulations. If a patient also has an end-of-life issue, and those conversations are discussed between the providers that there's a situation here which is significant and the patient faces an end-of-life situation, there are statutory regulations for that. But there's a gap in between. And I explained to you this because I served in that gap for all these years, but I never had any statutory authority to do so. And so I felt that it was important to bring this forward so that we could cover that period of time. Sometimes patients need something as simple as a PICC line. But if you or I were going to get a PICC line, we would consent for it. Or you need a CT with contrast. We would have to consent for that CT with contrast. Or we're found down, we're resuscitated, but there is a hip fracture. If we only give traction to that hip fracture, the person will have lifelong pain and disability. But if we pin the hip, and I'm going to speak about whether or not we know about their religious background or whatever, but if we pin it, the person is likely to go to rehab and recover. So an example would be an 81-year-old male found down and conscious with possible intestinal blockage. If we did a CT with contrast or a colonoscopy, we could find that blockage and see whether it's appropriate based on that person's situation and comorbidities to correct that on behalf of the patient. Sometimes patients have liver involvement and they become incapacitated and they have encephalopathy, a swelling in the brain. It's temporary in most cases, but they can't consent at the time. But they do need treatment for that situation. Or you find a young man, frankly, down under the bridge who has had dehydration and is failing to thrive. You bring that person in, you begin to do a resuscitation, you look at what their situation is, and suddenly you find that the person has a stiff neck and needs a lumbar puncture. But he cannot consent for that, and someone needs to consent. So this bill is not necessarily for those huge 1% cases where there's a big futility issue and you have to call an ethics consult service. I'm an assistant director for the Center for Ethics in Healthcare. I'm a formally trained ethicist, and many people have had formal training in ethics, including social workers, case managers, nurse managers, and, of course, physicians. They don't all have the same training. However, they have a basic training in understanding the principles of autonomy and beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. So the key here is to have someone available to make a decision on behalf of the patient. Not 3 weeks from now when the court can appoint a court-appointed guardian. And most of the counties do not have public guardians. And that takes at least 10 days. Hospitals have to make a considerable, it's called family notification. Social workers, case managers, myself, others who support the physicians, when a patient comes into the hospital, whether it's through the ER or is admitted, and there is no information about family or friends, and I'm going to be so glib as to say even drinking buddies are not available. We have to look at old records. We call state agencies to see if the person is well-known by a case manager, maybe in the mental health community or in the disability community. We have to look on the Internet. We have to do what's called a search. It's called family notification. All medical social workers have that as part of their master's training. And every hospital in the state of Oregon, as far as I know, because I called actually 14, but I have 10 documented here, they all have at least a social worker or a case manager who is trained to do that. So imagine that they've done this reasonable search. Then they call someone like myself or as a case manager to come and consent for the patient. We again ask and search ourselves. We call the police agencies, trying to figure out who this person is and if there might be somebody in the wings that we don't know about who is available to help us to understand what they would want. There are some patients, if we knew what their religious background is, for instance, Christian Scientist, we would respect that if we knew that, and not proceed to treat against what would be their will. Likewise, for a Jehovah's Witness patient who would not want to receive blood if it's known. But the most important thing here, I think, is the angst and the delay in care. And you could delay maybe one day for a lumbar puncture. You could delay 24 hours. But if there's somebody in the hospital who is available, now that could be the attending physician in a small hospital, and you would want to have somebody else collaborate with that attending physician, people could say, oh, conflict of interest. I have to tell you, the physicians I have known for all these years really do not want to be the consenters. They would prefer someone else so that they can distance themselves, make the recommendations of what would be a reasonable procedure, and then someone, whoever is appointed, let's say it's myself, can ask challenging questions. Is this in the patient's best interest? What is likely to occur as a result of this? And to document that in the medical record. So I have written for you all the interviews that I did with other hospitals around the state, the small ones. One person said, we're so frustrated we don't know what to do. And as we just go ahead and do it. Or we bundle them up and send them to a larger hospital for a higher level of care because maybe they will have the resources to do this. But we're frustrated because we know that we don't have any legal standing to go ahead and support this patient. So I could go on for some time about this, but I really like you to know that there's no intent to harm anyone, but to just provide that gap support. Thank you. I'll have to answer any questions you like.
We'll hear from all three of you, and then we'll open it for questions.
Please. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, Chair Thompson. My name is Janet Billups. I am General Counsel Emeritus of the Oregon Health and Science University. For many years, I was a formal academic member of the psychiatry department, in addition to serving in the legal department for nearly 24 years. In that period of time, I was the law faculty for our ethics certificate program that Mrs. Glidewell described. I taught the law component of that ethics certificate program, and I have continued since its inception, teaching being on the law faculty of our ethics transition to residency program for our fourth-year medical students who are getting ready to graduate. It's a small case-based program where we team up a physician and a lawyer who is skilled and knowledgeable on medical ethics in the law. And with that and with my work in the legal department in general, I'm here to continue to provide some information regarding the bill itself. I recognize that you all know the basics of the bill. So I want to take a moment just to comment that the process that we went through to include other members of our statewide community is that we had extensive conversations with hospital ethicists leading to support from hospital systems and others who you are going to hear about. There was outreach to the entire health law section of the bar, 275 lawyers who represent my field, and that led to, by my count, three supportive responses that led to some improvements in the bill. I have three comments about the bill itself that are going to be in response to what I believe is the key remaining difference between those of us who are the practitioners and another group who I believe you'll hear about regarding a difference of position in one issue, and that is the question of who may be the decision maker. The suggestion being it should be someone completely unaffiliated with the hospital, or it should be a large multidisciplinary committee structure. And of course, we're only talking about the unbefriended, people who have friends, family, who have signed an advance directive, who are in an emergency situation, or at the end of their life with life-sustaining treatment withheld are already covered by the law. Currently, physicians and nurses make these decisions. This is the reality of today. Mandating that physicians and other health care providers cannot make these decisions will further delay care and is a step backwards, not forwards. I can just say from the bottom of my heart, from fielding these questions from Mrs. Glidewell for 24 years, that is simply not workable. There are no independent, unaffiliated professionals who are available 24/7 to become involved in the care of the patient. In order to help address urgent care needs. Physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, such as social workers, do this now, and they need to continue that role, but we need it to be accompanied by some guidance. There is no guidance in the law now. This bill adds that guidance. The guidance is reasonable search for friends and family will be done according to professional standards as has been described. Ethics training has to be completed, and that will involve two key components in the ethics world, and that is that whoever's the decision maker has to have been trained in recognizing and managing conflicts of interest. The person also has to be trained in understanding that the role of the decision maker is one sole purpose, and that is to act in the best interest of the patient. My second point is that it relates, again, to this question of whether or not the attending or a hospital worker should be allowed to make this decision. The advanced directive law, current legislative policy, recognizes that there are two groups of patients. Those of us who have filled out an advanced directive and those who have not. Those who have not, for those who have filled out that form, it is true that the legislature expects them to have found a designee, found a healthcare representative, someone to speak for them who's not a hospital employee. But for those who have not filled out that form, current legislative policy is that when it comes to withdrawing or withholding life support, if the person is unbefriended, the attending physician can make that decision. That is current legislative policy. If a single physician, the attending, is trusted to decide to effectively bring someone's life to its natural end, then we suggest that the single attending physician should likewise be trusted to authorize a PICC line or a biopsy or any one of a number of daily, more than daily, multiple times a day sometimes, regular medical care that should be provided. Having said that, we heard the concerns and questions from the committee and have proposed Amendment A7, I think it's dash A7, that will require agreement from a second healthcare professional with ethics training when the attending is going to be the decision maker. As Mrs. Glidewell said, the attendings generally don't want to fill that role, but we can't presume that in everywhere in this state, in small cities and rural hospitals, that there is a multidisciplinary infrastructure in place. So when the attending is in a position to need to make that decision, the proposed amendment will provide that the attending must first confer with another healthcare professional with the same training. Senator Johnson supports this amendment as well. My last comment relates again to the notion of a large multidisciplinary committee as a suggestion, as the vehicle for decision-making that can work for some hospitals, and in fact it had one improvement in the bill is to recognize that that is how some hospitals choose to make these kinds of decisions. But mandating it for the rest of the state is not feasible for small cities or rural hospitals that don't have the infrastructure of big city systems. That completes my comments.
Thank you. Ryan?
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association. You have our written comments in front of you, so I'll just briefly summarize and let you know that we agree that there is a problem here that needs to be solved, and that this process that is currently before you in the bill will ensure that the patient receives care that as much as possible reflects their health care needs and desires. We also think that 579A has the proper safeguards included in it, and with regards to the A7, while we believe that the attending is capable of making those decisions, we understand the need for caution in adding that additional layer within the bill. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel?
I just may want to comment, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I helped in some of the discussions move to the A7s because I thought that would take away at least one of the serious objections that have been raised.
Yeah.
I support the A7s as well.
Okay. Parrish.
Thank you. I do have a question for you at OHSU, because one of the comments that I heard was, I can't remember if it was my office or last time we had panels up here talking about this, was this notion that somehow the one of the challenges that folks who might oppose this bill brought forward was that if the doctor might somehow have financial gain from making decisions for a patient who's otherwise incapacitated. But I want to just kind of get a sense of if someone, say, is homeless, comes in, you're making those decisions, odds are likely you're not getting paid on that decision anyway. Can we just dispel that, what I kind of see as a myth, of that somehow there's a financial motivation to making a decision on behalf of a patient who's incapacitated and can't make that and not has no friends, but somehow those decisions are going to be impacted by personal gain?
Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Parrish. The implication that physicians, as a category, that a general statement can be made that they are going to be corrupted by an attenuated financial benefit from an unsponsored patient or a sponsored patient, I think you described it best. It is a myth.
Can I follow up once?
Please.
The other concern I have around that same kind of mythology is that this notion that once the decision has been able to be in someone's hands, that potentially they might actually not make any kind of decision, which is still making a decision, i.e. saying, well, because now they're going to be charity care, we won't make a decision at all, but we have the authority to not make the decision. And I want to just get some sense that that also would be potentially something that your physicians wouldn't be doing, because that concerns me. And I have a great physician for my kids. I've never known her not to make the right decision, regardless of cost one way or the other.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Parrish. The change, the improvement that this law makes, is that it now mandates what my experience tells me physicians already do, which is to act in the best interest of the patient. So when a decision is made, if there is a follow-up decision, that physician now is required to act in the best interest of the patient. If it's a decision to not provide a certain kind of care because a different kind of care is warranted, that's what this law now says that the physician's required to do, act in the best interest of the patient. And there's a fair amount of literature and training that goes on in ethics programs around what is a best interest standard that Mrs. Glidewell probably would be able to speak to better than I can. But the standard does exist. In my experience, it simply describes what our well-trained, thoughtful physicians do now, but now it is going to codify that standard.
I guess I just bristled at the notion that somehow this bill is being brought forward because somebody might get financial gain out of it, when I can't imagine that the case. But it kind of rankled me the wrong way, and I wanted to get a sense of getting that on the record and having that part of conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Sir, I just want to comment. I think part of the concern is the opposite concern. It's that if a patient is unintended, has no health insurance, shows up, and the decision might be that there's surgery that's going to take me 6 hours to do now that I might do if I was going to get $10,000 for that surgery, and I might not do it under this circumstance. I think it's a little more of a concern in some instances. So I think having the second physician involved in that discussion, I think, mitigates against either side of that.
I guess my concern and what you just expressed was that you're saying, no, we want the permissive so that we can get to doing those procedures, and not that the choice is actually going to be, we'll do nothing now that we have the option of doing nothing. I don't believe, having been a patient at OHSU, every time I've ever been there that they haven't, and I've had times in my life when I've had no insurance, that when you show up, people aren't there to, they do the do no harm part. They get in there and they serve that. I don't like the mythology around somebody saying that we're giving you this decision so that you can do the wrong thing with it. It just bothers me.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we will now call Paul Cosgrove and Dave Fisco, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health, appearing here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 579 and the amendment that you have just had described to you. I just want to say very quickly, it's a common problem that hospitals face, as described to you. As you can imagine, this happens hundreds of times a day across the state. And the decisions are being made either by action or inaction now. What this bill does is it sets a framework after careful discussion amongst all the interested parties about how this decision should be made, and we support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiscom here for Providence Health and Services. Pleased to repeat here what we did say in the Senate Health Care Committee as this bill was considered. We supported Senate Bill 579 for several reasons. Today I do have a letter that my assistant, Paul Cosgrove, will give to the committee administrator.
What help's hard to find, right?
You get what help you can get where it's available. That's all I can say. Thank you, Paul. The letter that I'm giving you is signed by Mike Becker, for whom I work at Providence Health and Services. And you know, Mike, he would like to have been here today but couldn't. I'm going to just read you a few comments of that because it's important to do so for the record. One of Providence Health and Services' foundational beliefs is that health services be provided in a manner that respects the dignity of every patient. We understand, thus, the general rationale for Senate Bill 579 to protect the best interests and rights of incapacitated patients with no care directive, no friend or relative to help clarify medical decision-making. Our initial concerns with Senate Bill 579 as it was first introduced were that it might have unwittingly or unintentionally compromised one of our approaches, in fact, our approach on this issue. In non-terminal situations where an incapacitated patient has no advance directive, no close friend or family member to help with decision-making, we do convene, as is described in Senate Bill 579, a multidisciplinary ethical consultation team. Typically consists of a patient's primary care physician, other caregivers at the particular facility, the patient's legal counsel, if any, and a medical ethicist. With that well-established procedure in mind, we work closely with the bill's sponsor. I should thank Senator Johnson for her work, as well as our friends at OHNSU, to craft amendments that facilitate these alternative ethical solutions for healthcare institutions treating patients in these situations. The bill recognizes our situation. It recognizes the approach OHNSU uses with regard to a patient advocate program. That said, we have looked at the -787 amendments, and we are in support of those amendments as well. They deal, as they are specified, to deal with the provision of the section that deals with a healthcare provider as opposed to applying to a multidisciplinary team. All that said, Mr. Chairs, we support the bill and urge your affirmative action. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any questions.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I forgot to add one other point pursuant to a comment made by the previous witnesses. One of the suggestions that has been made along the way to us and that we said was just absolutely unworkable from a Providence Health System perspective was to have somebody independent engaged to make these decisions from outside of the hospital, outside of the multidisciplinary team that we've described in Senate Bill 579. For us, that is absolutely unworkable, and should that suggestion be made today, I wanted to go on record as being opposed to the designation of somebody totally independent from a hospital facility to be charged with these kinds of decisions. So thank you for allowing me to add that qualification, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next, we will invite up Alice Harmon Ava Bartley and Bob Jundev. State your name and begin.
Do you want me to go first?
No, I think Bob will.
Oh, I'll go first then. Okay. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ava Bartley. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. The DD Coalition is a group of approximately 30 developmental disability organizations throughout Oregon whose mission is to promote quality services and supports which respectfully further the rights, equality, justice, and inclusion for all Oregonians with developmental disabilities and their families. Our fundamental concern with Senate Bill 579 is that people with developmental and other disabilities who tend to be vulnerable may be mistakenly identified as the unbefriended person this bill is trying to address because they may be determined to be incapable of making their own health care decisions. Historically, hospitals and health care providers have varied greatly on how they approach the DD population and on the diligence they exercise in either listening to the person's wishes if they're capable of communicating them or in finding the individual's family, friends, or a guardian that can assist the individual in communicating their wishes with respect to health care decisions. We're basically worried that hospitals will too quickly resort to these surrogate decision-making procedures to supplant existing plans that an individual might already have in place. So specifically to the bill, we have the following concerns. One is around what constitutes a reasonable search for family and friends. The bill simply states that it must be in accordance with the hospital's policies and procedures for locating relatives and friends of a patient. I realize there are hospitals out there that may have quite an extensive process for locating family and friends, as was described by the previous panel. There also might be hospitals that have no policy for locating family or friends. So we believe at a minimum that reasonable search should be defined in the bill, that there should be a non-exclusive list of the records and information that should be consulted so that we have a statewide standard for kind of a statutory minimum for what constitutes a reasonable search, so that it's not left to hospital policies. And then a second concern about the bill is we believe there's an inherent conflict of interest in allowing a healthcare provider to serve as the appointee to provide informed consent under the bill. Our understanding of informed consent is basically that it's a conversation that involves at a minimum two people. One person is the healthcare provider who gives information about the plan of care, the risks and benefits of treatment, and then the other party is either the patient or an advocate for the patient if needed. Under this bill proposes that there's one person involved in the conversation. Basically, the hospital or healthcare provider is filling both of those roles. And that it doesn't seem like you have informed consent in that situation when there's only one party involved in those discussions. We believe that it poses both ethical and financial conflicts of interest potentially by having the person in both of those roles. So we may remain very concerned about these issues, and we believe further discussion and study is needed to come up with an appropriate solution for the informed consent problem that hospitals are facing. And actually, this intelligent and thoughtful person on my right, Mr. Jundev, has drafted some amendments that meet our concerns. I reviewed the Dash 7 amendments in coming into the hearing here, and while they're a step in the right direction, they don't go far enough to address the concerns that we have about the bill. Mr. Jundev has drafted some proposed amendments that do address our concerns. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Who wants to go next?
I'll go. My name is Alice Harmon. I'm an attorney in Kaiser. I do elder law, and I'm here because of my personal concerns about some of the possible ramifications from the bill. I first learned about the bill about a month ago. I'm aware that sometimes when legislation is proposed that you invite all stakeholders to the table ahead of the legislative session and hash out the concerns of the different parties. This wasn't apparently done in developing this bill, and I'd like to see the bill tabled until next session so that people who are representing elders and the vulnerable can get together with representatives of the hospitals and address the concerns from multiple angles. It's been the policy in this state to protect the vulnerable. We have the guardianship statutes that help to protect the vulnerable. We have an advance directive that allows each person to state their own wishes when they're facing drastic care or an emergency situation. In the advance directive statute, it is prohibited to name a health care provider. In the guardianship statute, it is prohibited to name a health care provider. And that's simply a policy decision of the state of Oregon in that the person who provides or the entity who provides the health care has an inherent conflict of interest with the decisions that are going to be made. It could be financial. It could be just a matter of whatever. But it seems to me that what this bill does is it says that the more vulnerable you become, when you get to the point that you're so vulnerable that you no longer can state your own wishes, and you're so vulnerable that you don't even have a friend to come and help you out with it, at that point, the health care provider can step in. I think we need to provide more safeguards, not fewer. I've heard a couple of phrases here, best interests. I've also heard substituted judgment, and I've heard their needs and desires referring to the patient. And that was from the testimony from last week and from today. Those are two conflicting standards. The best care standard is one standard. The substituted judgment standard is another. You can't have both because they conflict. They'll cancel each other out. So I think we need to get clear on what standard it is that we're talking about and which one we want to go for. In this bill, there's no oversight. There's no appeal. There's no right to take a decision to a judge. In any other situation, there is. In a guardianship or in committing someone, you have a chance for notice. You have a chance to go to the court, and you need to do a certain amount of reporting. There's no reporting. There's no state agency. What this bill would do would be to authorize each hospital or each care provider to assume that much authority on their own and keep it effectively secret. That concerns me a little bit. I'm not sure that the bill is really needed. As we've heard, practitioners are doing the very best they can under some very difficult situations. They're already making decisions in an emergency situation, and I think that we should let them continue to do that, to do the best that they can. I'm also concerned about the references to no public guardian. The guardianship chapter provides for a public guardian for each county. Any county that wants a guardian, public guardian can have one. So that's already in place. They just need to go and do it. Guardianship does take 15 days. There's a temporary guardianship for emergency situations that takes 3 days, and it's also possible to have that 3 days waived if there's an emergency situation that arises that needs to be addressed immediately. And so for those reasons, I'm testifying in against the bill, and I'd like to see it tabled and let us get into some substantive discussions in the interim before next session. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob?
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon is a federally funded legal service that provides assistance to people with disabilities across the state of Oregon. And one of the things that we are charged to do is to look at laws such as the ones that you are considering before you in terms of how they protect the rights of people with disabilities. Which is what we have done. I'd like to start out just by saying that we do not question the motives of the proponents of this bill. We think their motives are of the best quality and interest, and they're working to try to find something that is workable for them. One of the things in any legislative process, of course, is that there's multiple interests involved. And what you have heard from the proponents is the interest of hospitals and healthcare providers. You haven't heard from consumers of services and people who are concerned about what might happen to them when they enter into these systems. In my conversations with people in those communities, what I have learned is that they do have concerns. Those concerns were reflected in our advanced directive laws and our guardianship laws. As you know, they both take into account conflict of interest or perceived conflict of interest, and those are written into those statutes. And those statutes have the benefit of a lot of discussion, both before session and during session, in order to come up with a workable program for everyone. In this case, for example, today I just received a call from the Oregon Disabilities Commission that asked me to voice their opposition to this bill because they were concerned about the conflict of interest problem. Individual practitioners who work in the elder law area, as you have heard, are concerned about the conflict of interest problem. And so this is something that we have definitely heard from those communities. In terms of looking for solutions to that potential conflict, this is something that our feeling is that there was a way to work it out. We have suggested in my testimony, you'll see one way to work it out, which is just to make sure that there are multiple people involved in the decision making. The proponents have not been comfortable with that bill, that proposal, deeming it to be unworkable. This is their realm. I do not work in a hospital, but one thing I do know about this particular bill is that it's permissive. It's not mandatory. In having discussions about this scheme and talking to some hospitals, they said, we have ways of handling this now. We don't need another way, but we take comfort in knowing that this is not mandatory. We will not have to change the way we do business because of this bill, because it doesn't make us do anything. It is merely something that permits hospitals to follow a particular course of action. And so our feeling is that there is no hospital in the state of Oregon that will be mandated to do anything by passage of this bill. They will be able to continue to use the practices that they have had. It's important to recall also that this bill will cover an entire range of medical procedures. So, yes, it could just be a PICC line we're talking about, but it could be all the way to major surgery. And there is no differentiation in this bill between types of procedures that could require very invasive, very risky procedures versus very simple things that aren't emergent but need to be taken care of. And we think that is an important distinction. As has already been brought up, right now in the bill, policies for looking for family, friends, advanced directives, and other things are left to hospital policy. We also agree that we think it would be better, and what consumers have told us is that they would feel more comfort if there were some steps that were specifically put in place to require what a search might be for. So these are some of the things that we have proposed. And we think that would make this a better bill. That having been said, I'd like to thank Representative Greenlee for coming forward with the -7 amendments. This, we think, is a step forward. And again, raising the concern that has been raised by others is that informed consent should be a conversation rather than a dictate. We recognize that there is a provision for end-of-life decision-making, that after everything else has been done, that decision can be left to the attending physician. We resisted that when it was enacted. We still don't like it. We think any decision should be a conversation. And so that is so we think that the -7s is a step forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gordy?
Thank you. I guess it's for the entire panel. What I heard you guys talk about was guardianships and court orders and all these kind of things. And my question is short of having one of you at a hospital 24/7 in every hospital in the state, what happens to the patient that's very ill or needs some procedure or whatever while all of this sort of procedure goes on? It looks like the patient's kind of forgotten in this in this legal scenario. And so my question is how do you deal with a timely issue if you know, you're saying you need this and you need to have a guardianship and you need to have the legal procedure and all this for an unbefriended person, not a DD person, but an unbefriended. So I'm kind of concerned for the patient here. They're sitting there in pain and you guys are going to judges.
Yeah, doctors are authorized now by statute if there's an emergency, an emergent need, that they can make that decision.
Well, but it's if I could have a follow-up, but it's not always an emergency because when we talked about this last week, it was something, I mean, it could be, you know, a gallbladder or something that somebody might be in pain, but it would take, it's not something that you had to do in the next hour or two. And so my concern is what's happening to the patient while all of this procedure is going on? And I also disagree with the thing. If you've got a doctor that's doing it for money, they're not going to be a physician very long. So, but I'm concerned that the patient's just kind of sitting and laying. And what do you propose?
Mr. Chair, as Representative Doherty, first of all, we didn't bring up the money conflict, but I think that what people are sensitive to is that there can be other considerations in terms of practice, be it time, insurance, alternate treatments that are best addressed by having a conversation with somebody else who's knowledgeable. We didn't understand, and the amendments that I proposed do not understand that the second person has to be present, has to do an examination of the individual who would be treated. It's our view that there can be someone who is available by phone or through other forms of communication for whom a scenario can be run by and there can be a conversation about it and some feedback back and forth. And so that's, in terms of our amendments, we're trying to encourage people to talk to each other. And to bring in a different perspective and one so that there's a richness in that decision making. And we believe that can be done in a timely fashion. We understand that there's testimony from the hospitals that this is unworkable, but we believe that conclusion is because we actually have never sat down in the same room with a variety of interests and had that conversation in the entire process of this bill. And that is something that we would ask to see happen prior to enacting something that can have some serious consequences for the patient that you're concerned about.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how in depth you've went through the bill here, but on line 25, actually starts on 24, of this section, may give informed consent to medically necessary health care services on behalf of and in the best interest of a patient admitted to a hospital. Then it goes into the with the medical, and that's where we've made a couple amendments for you and everything. So I can't see anybody getting too carried away because a doctor would open himself up for liability if they weren't acting in the best interest of the patient or doing something that was wrong. And this isn't for just developmental disabled. This is all patients that are unbefriended. So it could be any one of us, actually any one of us could lose our friends any time in the legislature because politicians aren't liked very well. But, I mean, it's not just developmental disabilities. This is if you can't find somebody and they're looking out for your best interest. And we don't have doctors that really act out of this guideline. So I was with you on your one concern, and that's why Representative Greenlick has those amendments. But I'm just trying to see why we keep dragging this out, because we know we have a serious issue here that we have to deal with and why we want to make it progress it on and on to where we don't end up with any bill to help people. So I'd like your thoughts on that.
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Widener, you've stated the standards, but the question I think that we're raising is who makes that decision? When you say something is in someone's best interest, who decides if it's in their best interest or not? And what we're encouraging is that there be a conversation about that rather than it being left to folks who, and again, I'm I say this for emphasis rather than to be accusatory in any way. I really want to respect everybody in this process because everybody's trying to do the right thing, but that we not have a rubber stamp, that it just not be a okay, off we go type of thing, but there is actually a conversation. That's really what we're trying to get at, not the standard itself, because those are good standards. And we support them. And if you look in the, again, in the amendments that we proposed, you know, we're comfortable with those standards. We think they're good. We just want to encourage there to be collaboration in making the decision.
Attorney Parrish.
Thank you. I guess I'm still kind of struggling to wrap my hands around this because every time I've ever been in a hospital or my husband's been in a hospital, the doctor who's wandering through the halls working with us is not doing it in a vacuum. He's not out there by himself, not conferring with other people on his floor about our cases when we've had that experience. I guess the other concern I have is if Representative Weiner winds up friendless at the hospital, which, by the way, I come bail you out.
Me too.
But, if somebody winds up in that situation, the hospital assumes a lot of responsibility walking through the door. I mean, you could have a patient, for lack of an ability to have a process that makes a decision, you could have a patient just laying there in limbo, and that costs everybody in the system. And again, what Representative Weiner read about in the best interest, I'm really struggling to wrap my hands around that some physician is just going to randomly play God in that scenario and not have any other sideboard input of a nurse, of a technician, of a phlebotomist, of somebody else in that situation when they're working together as a team. I've never not been in the hospital and not had care given as a team. So I do worry about a patient who's just, like Representative Dory said, just sitting there in limbo, waiting for the process. And I guess if this fails, if we were to pass this and it fails, then let's bring it back to the legislature and fix it. But just the inability to get to know or wait for another session, we do a lot of that around here, and it's no wonder we don't get a lot done because, we need every side of the angle perfectly studied. We can't just get to, yes, try it, and if it doesn't work the way we think it, want it to work, we can't just come back and resolve it in the next session versus waiting session after session to get something done. I struggle with that. Mm-hmm.
Could I respond to that? Please. Co-chairs and Representative Parrish. I think that the person wandering the hospital hallways is well-intentioned and there's no implication that they're not. I think the point is that you can't truly advocate for somebody's interests when you have other interests that you also represent. So in that case...
Clarify what those other interests are.
Well, the person being employed by the hospital, having their salary paid by the hospital. So they, even in the back of their mind, even though they have a standard to work under, you can't truly sanitize the conflict. You can't be without conflict because you're answering to that authority. And then you can't truly step in the shoes of the patient and advocate for their interests because you have other people that you're answering to and accountable for your actions. So really, it's in terms of that informed consent, there's just one person involved in the conversation. That's how we view it.
I still think the do no harm trumps employer, but I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we have two more. Jim Cox and Mike Schmidt, please. Okay. Okay, thank you.
And just for the record, we do have his written testimony that was submitted back on the 18th, so that you folks should have that as well.
I guess you're going to close it out for us all by yourself.
I guess I will. Members of the committee, co-chairs, I'm Jim Cox, for the record. I've been practicing law in Oregon for going on 84 years. No, 54 years. I'm going on 84.
There we go.
That sounds better, doesn't it? In private practice, native Oregonian, I first became, I'm a member of the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar, although I'm not here speaking as their representative. First heard about this bill less than a month ago. And I'm not going to repeat everything that's been said by the people who talked before me, certainly. But I have a couple of observations I'd like to make. somebody said that that these doctors don't play God when they make these decisions by themselves. Well, I don't care how many people they talk to, that is unfortunately or necessarily a decision the doctors have to play God at some point. They do. And let's face it. Now, I know they're more comfortable if they have input from other people, and the more procedures we put in place to put window dressing on it, if you will, the better they feel about it. But bottom line is that somebody, some individual human being, usually a doctor, does play God in these situations. So let's not fool ourselves that by putting another layer of procedures and statutes and so forth in front of it, that we're going to change that basic dynamic. That remains. And I kind of regard this bill as perhaps a solution looking for a problem. These decisions have been made forever, let's say, at least for the last 50 or 60 years in terms of relatively modern medicine, and even more so as medicine becomes more sophisticated and more capable of doing all kinds of different things. It becomes more complicated. But the basic problems have arisen hundreds of times a day, as some other witness said a little while ago, in hospitals throughout Oregon. And they have been resolved. And I have not heard of any hospital or physician being sued by somebody because they made the decision that appeared to be best under the information that was available to them at that time and in light of the seriousness of the emergency. Some decisions have to be made on a minute-by-minute basis. Some can wait for weeks. But to try to put a window dressing, such as what I call this bill, put window dressing on it, to kind of put a blessing on all of this, is nothing more than making somebody feel more comfortable. The physicians and the hospitals have been making these decisions for years, and I think that until something happens to get everybody together to reach some kind of a consensus, instead of it just being a hospital bill, if you will, I don't think we ought to add this to our already way too thick Oregon revised statutes. I'm not advocating, I would be totally opposed to any kind of a system that was a legalistic system that comprehended having to go see a judge or file a petition or go through that kind of stuff. That's not the way these decisions need to be resolved. They need to be resolved based on the circumstances that are present and the immediacy and the urgency of the decision. And people of good spirit and good heart need to make these decisions if the patient cannot make them himself or herself. And that's the way it always has been, and that's the way it will continue to be. And until you just say, folks, you have been working it out. If you can come together with something better than what's now being proposed, something other than just window dressing, we'll take a look at it. But right now, that's all you're dealing with is window dressing. Thank you. Unless somebody has some questions,
Any questions of this?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Do you have any sense of what that solution might be?
I really don't.
Maybe it's just continue to operate the way we're operating. Obviously, that gives the hospitals and maybe some others discomfort.
I'm not in the medical profession, so I don't look at it from their point of view, but from my point of view, it works pretty well the way it is right now. And I would also say, if kind of off track a little bit, may I say something else here that I really didn't before, that I really skipped over before? The language of this bill, this is just a matter of draftsmanship, but it is a monster to try to understand what it means. You have a situation with exceptions, with exceptions, with exceptions to the exceptions. And man, that is tough. And then there's a sentence in here that says, in terms of talking about who the hospital has to try to reach to find somebody to make the decision, among others, it lists the Oregon Health Authority, Department of Human Services, or Department of Human Services, if the hospital has reason to believe the patient has a case manager with the authority or the department. What does that mean? I don't know. Is that just a typo? It doesn't make any sense. And the statute, the list of people you're supposed to contact, does not include court-appointed guardians or conservators. I'm not talking about going out and getting a guardian or a conservator. One, it's already in place. There's nothing in here that says they've got to look for that. So there's just a lot of flaws with this bill. I'm not sure it's necessary. I imagine that a committee of smart people from both sides of the fence could sit down and hammer out something a lot better, given time to do it. But I think this is premature and has been addressed in good faith from the side of, from one side of the equation. And there are indeed are two sides to this equation.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Excuse me.
Real quick one.
Sure.
Because you said we actually do have a problem here. The problem is the unbefriended people, and that's what this deals with, and that's where the language that you're looking at is, hey, these are the people we need to find out if they have a caseworker or anybody there that can come on their behalf. It's when they don't have anybody at that situation. And it's what we're trying to get at is a patient that they need a medically necessary procedure and having to wait 2 or 3 days to get something that they could be in tragic pain for, to wait for them to find somebody rather than get the care that they need. That's what this bill is trying to address. So now they don't have to wait 2 or 3 days to go through all of these hoops to get something done that they need done. And this is to help people that are out there hurting. So I don't know if you have looked into the bill that much or if you really know the issue, but I think this provides us a very good solution for what we're trying to do. Because if you were in a hospital and you needed something done, do you want to wait 2 or 3 days while you're suffering for them to find somebody, or would you rather have it done the next day?
Well, speaking, if I may, I'll give you an example from my personal experience. About 5 years ago, I was in a very serious accident riding a bicycle, and I was too old to be doing that, I think. But anyhow, I was in OHSU in intensive care for 5 days and then 4 more days after that. And they were doing all kinds of things for me and to me, and I appreciated it, and I got fine care at OHSU. But, you know, they didn't come and ask me if they could put in the some of these complicated things they were putting in my body that I know, Foley catheters to administer different things with, those kinds of things. They just did it, and I was glad they did. But somebody made that decision, and there are risks to a Foley catheter. They did it. And I, frankly, I was pretty sick and pretty hurting, but I was conscious, but they didn't even ask me. So that's the way the medical profession basically works. They ask the patient and get informed consent when they think it's necessary or appropriate or practical. Otherwise, they go ahead and do what they think needs to be done.
If I may follow up.
Please.
On that there, though, you signed a consent form when you first went in, or your wife or somebody had signed one for them to be able to do all that stuff to you, did they not?
Probably. I don't remember.
And this is for the situation where there isn't somebody there to sign it. You had somebody there for you, and they knew what needed to be treated. So
that's true.
We have a problem, and this is the solution for the problem. So to say we're creating a problem and we don't have a solution, I think, is wrong.
Well, I guess you're going to vote in opposition to the way I feel about it. That's all I can say. We just
disagree.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on 579A, and this will be back on Friday, May 27th, for a possible work session. And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 91A. And Madam Assistant, would you fill us in on that bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, you'll recall that Senate Bill 91, we had a public hearing on May 9th. This requires health insurance carriers to offer in the individual and small group market in which that carrier offers a health benefit plan to provide the bronze and silver plan coverage. It specifies the requirements for their catastrophic plans, and it specifies operative dates. The operative date of January 2nd, 2014. There are no amendments on the bill. It left the Senate floor with 26 ayes, 3 noes, and 1 excused. It's no revenue impact, and it has a minimal fiscal impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on Senate Bill 91A?
Or the work session.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 91A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Greenlick has moved Senate Bill 91A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Oh. Is there any discussion on the motion? Did that mean something? Or?
I just having stepped out of the room. I need to check which it is. Did we get any additional testimony from Rocky, or are we just moving forward?
No, but he is in the room with you.
I'm okay.
One to testify for us.
You have
any more testimony? Just confuse me further.
Do you have a question we'd like to refer to Rocky, or
nope?
I'm good with it now. If he comes up, he could change my opinion.
Okay.
Exactly.
Is there any more discussion on Senate Bill 91A? Or on the motion, I'm sorry. If not, then will you read the roll?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Yes.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative Whitehead?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye. Sounds like the ayes have it. So, carrier?
Yeah, you'll need a carrier.
And we'd like to carry that bill?
Or you can do a consent.
No, you
have to
do this consent.
Okay.
It's an option.
Chair Greenlee, would you like this one?
No.
I can carry it.
Representative Hoyle?
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle will carry this bill. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 91A. Okay, now we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 86A, but for a particular purpose. We don't have the paperwork, so we can't work it today, but we have two amendments, 1A3 from Representative Parrish and one from Representative Hoyle, A4s, but I understand Lou Savage is going to speak to those. So,
Or Anthony
or somebody. Let's hear on the A4s first, and then Representative Parrish, if you'd like to speak on the A3s or your designee.
That would be my own designee.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we're just having, we're just going to have these two amendments presented today,
right,
and then close the hearing. So,
For the record, again, my name is Anthony Behrens. As far as I know, I'm still a senior policy analyst with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 86, A4, it's a very simple amendment. It removes the provisions that would prohibit a retainer medical practice from charging more than 1 month of an advance fee, and also removes the provision talking about reimbursement. The reason for the amendment is that there is a concern that these practices would not be able to operate if patients essentially churned in and out of the practice. So they would sign up for 1 month and then go and get multiple services and then quit, come back 5 months later, pay 1 month, sign up again. So that would not be something providers have indicated, and the department agrees that would not lend itself to the success of these types of practices. Happy to answer any questions you might have about
questions on the A3 amendments.
Four, right?
These
that
A4.
Was four.
A4, I'm fours. Sorry, A4. Yes.
Those were Representative Hoyle's amendments, right?
Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, and Representative Widener, yes.
And then we have the amendments for the gentleman who had brought it forward. There's one little piece of language we needed to change in it to allow them to practice. Or maybe that was the A4s. And testimony.
No. Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, Representative Widener, there was testimony. I believe Mr. Barber testified last time about these particular provisions that the A4 amendments are modifying, taking out. And I think that that was the major concern that was expressed by the... It's the only concern I know about that's expressed by providers.
We're not working the bill today, so if there's another amendment we need to do, let's get cracking.
On the A4s.
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand your logic behind that. I mean, I can understand. I sign up. I pay a month at a time because I don't know if they're going to be there. They're not an insurance company, right? You're not requiring them to have any reserves. So they may go out of business 2 months from now. I don't know. I don't understand why that's about churning. I perfectly understand if I stop paying, they can say you can't come back for 12 months. I don't have a problem with that. But they're not promising me anything beyond what I pay for, are they? I mean, I don't want them churning me as a, oh, I'm sorry, no, we decided we're not doing this anymore. Is there anything that stops them from doing that?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, if I understand your question, is if a practice were to, say, require a six-month commitment and then after 1 month, say, terminate the agreement, is that kind of your question? What would prevent them from doing that?
Yeah, I understand. I want to be in your practice. And if you want to be in that practice, you pay me a certain amount first of every month. You don't pay me something the first of every month, you're out. And you can't come back in for 12 months. Now, why doesn't that prevent churning?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, I don't believe that there is a provision in this bill that would prevent them from coming back. I don't think there's a 12-month prohibition. Maybe I'm not understanding your question. I'm sorry.
My question is, this is not an insurance company.
Correct. So
I'm not signing up for a year with Kaiser, and Kaiser will be there for a year because you've made sure they have the reserves and they'll honor that contract. There's nothing like that. So I want to come into your medical practice. You're not guaranteeing me you'll be there 12 months or 24 months from now. You're saying, come to my practice, give me some money, we'll take care of you. Now, why can't we do that 1 month at a time?
The providers have indicated that there are upfront administrative fees and costs involved with signing people up. And so if a person signs up for 1 month, comes in multiple visits, and obtains multiple services, and then stops paying and doesn't come back, and then in the event that under the bill as it was originally written, in the event that they had paid in advance, the practice then has additional costs involved in refunding the money. It's just not a workable business model for them. Apparently OHSU...
So who cares? I mean, it's a workable business model or it's not. I don't care.
Well, I think that these amendments will help make it a workable business model and will help these practices to succeed.
But your job is not to make them successful. Your job is to protect the patients. Right? Are you DCBS? Is that? So, I mean, do you think your job is to make sure that all business models are successful? Is that what DCBS means, or is it to protect the customer?
Chair Thompson, Chair Green, I apologize. That's not what I was trying to say. If these models don't succeed, they won't offer any benefit to consumers. And if they don't succeed, there's the risk they will fail, and then they won't provide the promised benefits to consumers. So if we can make these practices work, then they will benefit the consumers the way that they're supposed to, and by extension will not result in harm to consumers. If we set up a model that just will not work, there's no benefit to consumers, and there is probably resulting harm.
Yeah, well,
Chairman Hoyle, I sense you want to weigh into this somehow.
A little bit.
Okay.
I know that in the pilot model that we had in Lane County, one of the reasons that we put this together was because it addressed a need for a population that couldn't afford insurance, couldn't afford access to care, and needed access to primary care. One of the reasons why I feel so strongly that we need registration with DCBS is that there is the potential, if you although it's different, if you compare this to a gym, like a 24-hour fitness, where you're paying every month, and then we've seen that some of these gyms go out of business, and you pay a year ahead of time, and, you know, that's an issue that we certainly don't want to see. We don't want fly-by-night operations. We don't want people who to get taken advantage of, which is why, again, I feel strongly, and Senator Cruz explained very clearly why having oversight by DCBS is important. I also understand that although some of these organizations may want to have patients on a monthly retainer, which is, again, the organization that's in Lane County, that's what they do, but for other organizations, they wanted the freedom to bill possibly quarterly or, you know, within a certain period of time. But as DCBS, would it not be under your jurisdiction to make sure that if a consumer paid for a certain set of services or access, that they would actually get those services and access, regardless if they paid monthly or quarterly or biannually?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Hoyle, that's exactly right. Under the registration process, the Department of Consumer and Business Services would have some oversight over these companies, and if they were, for lack of a better term, screwing consumers in this way, we would certainly step in and revoke their certification, and then they would then become subject to the insurance code if they continue to operate, which has a whole other set of regulations.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see this actually is a bill that is very positive for the consumers, that person who falls in the middle ground. Maybe they're in between employment and they can't afford a COBRA extension, but they just need coverage to where, hey, I have an ear infection or something like that, where they can go see a doctor and have something reasonable for their family. And to me, that's the intent and the purpose behind the bill. Is that what was being construed to you when you were drafting this?
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, one of the primary drivers for us putting forth this bill was to it was kind of a dual purpose: to allow these practices that seem to be providing benefits to consumers, and then. With a hope that there would be increased access for this population you talked about, the uninsured, the people who can't afford comprehensive medical coverage, to obtain primary care.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind holding tight for a minute, we'll talk about the A3s, and you may need to weigh in on that depending on where we go. Senator Parrish?
Thank you. I can do that from up here, right? You don't need me to go around.
You
the
may.
Side.
You're granted permission or whatever.
This bill and this concept is kind of fascinating to me, and it's another example, I think, of where the government wants to step in and manage somebody's business model, and I'm not, as a business owner, okay with that. I like the idea of giving folks the exemption to come up with a philosophy around how to help serve patients. Quite frankly, if my doctor was going to charge me some chickens and home-baked bread for medical care, I kind of wouldn't care about that too much. I think that I don't. When we had a customer, taxpayer, voter, came to us and we were asking questions like, "How much money do you make?" I don't think that's our business, quite frankly. So this amendment is actually about saying that, yes, let's give you the exemption so that you can do your job, so that you can transact with a patient the way you see fit, and that we're not going to add another government hoop, red tape, license you, regulate you, babysit you on some database somewhere. Let people make those decisions on their own. We heard folks, and I talked to a couple of the doctors afterwards, and asked the question, did you work with this with an attorney? yes, based on the current statutes, to the best of our ability, there is some, this piece about clarity of whether we're insurance or not, and we'd like the exemption, that yes, we worked with an attorney. It's kind of what people hire attorneys for. I feel confident that we can give an exemption and not also make a business. Healthcare is still a business, whether any of us like it or not, but make that business actually jump through one more hoop in Oregon to do business. Because while we're not going to charge anybody to register now, kind of feels like a segue bill where maybe in another session we'll come back and ask to charge a fee, and then we'll come back and do some more regulation of this when these doctors just kind of want to go out their day and help people without the rigmarole and red tape of more business. So that's why I've asked for this amendment. Probably, you know, won't go anywhere, but I want to get it on the record that I think it's not in the best interest of this body to be mandating and regulating every part of somebody's business. And healthcare is still a business, so I'd ask for the consideration for the amendments.
Thank you. Any further discussion on those amendments? We're not moving anything today. There's just information to put these on the record. And do you have any comment?
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Greenlight.
Yeah, can I just ask Representative Parrish?
Bet.
What's left out? You put back some stuff. What are the major components?
The past part I asked for, and I need to go back through and look at them again and understand. Well, actually, when I called down to LC to ask for some support on just taking out the registration part, it actually turned into a little bit of a policy debate on the phone, and I had some challenges around that. The only part I really wanted to take out is I think we should exempt the provider, and because I don't feel that this is insurance, but the registration piece was the part that I wanted to see, that we're not going to come make them register and babysit them.
Does it do it?
I believe it does.
Chair Thompson.
But again, it was kind of a fight to even get the, you know, kind of conversation. I'm like, just all we need is this, and we'll debate the policy piece of it up here. So,
Chair Greenlick, if I may. My understanding of the A3s is that it does remove the registration requirement. However, it leaves in all of the, I guess, enforcement provisions. And I guess one issue you may consider with the bill in that form is that we would be essentially unaware of any of these practices without any kind of registration. Right. So I'm not sure that the enforcement provisions by themselves would have much of an impact. In addition, under current law, these practices, a lot of them, many of them, would be considered insurance. And there is a very large body of insurance law that is aimed at protecting consumers. And the registration process that is envisioned under this legislation is essentially a 2 or 3 page document that you would file it with a 1 page renewal. We have a similar process for discount medical plans that we envision this process fitting under. So as far as being burdensome, the department believes it is minimal, but that it is something that's important to ensure that consumers are getting what it is that they pay for, and that we can monitor and track these practices to ensure that occurs.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Now, I spend a lot of money every month with a technical company in Beaverton, and I sign the contract. Truthfully, without my lawyer present, and I've been involved in that contract for 3 years, I know essentially what I'm paying for. Every now and then I have questions. I ask the questions, and to your point about whether or not we'd actually know if somebody was doing it, I think if the consumer was getting to you, use your word, screwed, they would bring that forward. I don't think the tracking mechanism here that we're talking about is as necessary as one might think. If a consumer gets into a situation where they, you know, think they're getting something they're not, then there is a mechanism. It's false advertising. It's a whole bunch of things. It's contract law, tort law. the other piece that I have is there are other business models for whom we're not doing this. And I don't want to open up the floodgates, but I don't think we're chasing prepaid legal this way or anything else that you prepay a service. I prepay the gym. It doesn't mean I'm going to get skinny anytime soon unless I actually go use it. We do this all the time, and I just kind of don't understand why. I know, that's right. I don't understand why there's such angst around babysitting and regulating this and not letting people go about their day and enter into contracts with sane-minded individuals, let's hope, who choose to do something different for their own health care and not have to have the provider have another hoop from the government that says, here's how you're going to operate and live in your day and your business. More than anybody sitting here, I probably am the person who's going to advocate the most for a consumer in the whole don't pull the wool over their eyes. But I also think that when a consumer chooses to go sideways of an insurance company and works out some other deal and opts into a plan in a contract, there are already laws that protect consumers to do that. I like the idea of exempting the providers so that they can do that, and maybe we can actually then turn around and learn from them in a different way about how to get to health care in this country.
Okay, I assume that then if there's any discrepancies in the amendments between now and the next time, we'll look at those and figure out if they're going to work all right. And we can't move the bill today. We have no paperwork anyway. So we're going to roll it over to carry it over to Wednesday is the next opportunity. And that, of course, means we have to have the paperwork. So we may
we'll
be seeing
hand engrossed versions of it, so we'll have a chance to.
Okay, so but we have the purpose of this hearing was just to get those two amendments entered onto the record. We won't work them. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on the Senate Bill 86A. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 201A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 201A had a public hearing on May 16th. You'll recall that this authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to approve transfer of 500 or more enrollees from one prepaid managed care health service organization, or MCO, to another under certain specified circumstances. This declares an emergency effective on passage. You do have the A5s in front of you, and what the A5 amendments are doing is just specifying that the Oregon Health Authority obtain federal approval from CMS before making any contract changes. That piece of the bill has an operative date of January 1, 2012, so they have a little bit of time to get that waiver, and the rest of the bill will take effect immediately. There's no revenue impact on the A5s. There is a fiscal statement, but the statement specifies that it has a minimal expenditure impact on the health authority.
But you need an amendment then on the A5, right?
No, we're good to go.
We're good to go. Okay, we're good then. Okay.
So
we have a motion on to adopt the A5.
Correct, Mr. Chair, if that's the committee's direction. And if you have any questions, there are proponents in the audience. If you
I'm going to oppose it to do somebody else.
Do you want to hold it up?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm willing to have it go on the vote. I'm opposed to it, but I'm willing to let the committee decide.
Mr. Chair, just the A5s again. I'm sorry that I was still pulling on my information. So where did they come from, and can someone describe them?
The A5 amendments were at the request of the Department of Medical Assistant Programs, Judy Moore Peterson, and then I believe it was Rose Cox, who's representing the proponents of the bill and was working with Senator Bates. Judy Moore Peterson's submitted testimony requested that they would need some time to get CMS approval on making any contract changes, and then suggested the January 1, 2012 date. So we had those amendments drafted on behalf of the department, and everybody was okay with them, to the best of my knowledge.
Would you rather move this forward? I mean, I'm sensing some reluctance.
I'll be glad to move the amendments, and I'll oppose the bill. No, I'm perfectly happy to have the committee decide it.
I would actually, this is the first time I went through the A5s, so is there anybody here to testify on the A5s?
Yeah. Rose?
Mr. Chair?
Or?
Yeah. Can we hear from
you? No.
I have an email that shows that everybody's okay with it, but we do have...
Chair Thompson, Chair Green, like members of the committee, and my name is Rose Cox, and I'm here representing the Children's Health Alliance on behalf of this bill. The A5 doesn't actually change any of the policy of the bill. The bill is still reading where one person, an individual, an OHP, rather than changing in the first 30 days of their enrollment, can change their health plan one time throughout their enrollment. So it's the same policy, just extending it throughout the whole year. And then adding that the authority may approve a transfer of 500 more enrollees if something happens, like the Yakima Valley Indians a few years ago. I can only think of two times that the 500 group has ever been an issue. When Children's Health Alliance, their IPA, switched contracts between plans, their patients wanted to switch with them. The A5 strictly changes the effective date of the 500 language to allow the OHA to get CMS approval and for contract changes that would be necessary under this provision.
If you give me a minute, I'm probably still good with the A5s. I was good with the bill before, so mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way it was rewritten was a little funny because the way we had to make the timelines work.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A5. Amendments to the bill to get it on the table for discussion.
Okay. Chair Greenlink has moved to adopt the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 201A, dated 5/19/11. Further discussion?
I would say that I'm opposed to the bill, but the A5 improves the bill, so I'm happy to support the A5.
Any further discussion on the A5s?
Nope.
Okay.
It's one page, pretty...
I guess we can call the roll for the A5 amendments, please.
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Yes.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
The Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
The Vice Chair Kinnaman?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Nelson? Aye. Okay, the A5s then are adopted to Senate Bill 201A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 201 as amended with the A5s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kennever has moved Senate Bill 201 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'm going to oppose this motion, and I may or may not speak against it on the floor, on the assumption that it moves. I think the Oregon Health Plan needs to follow basic health insurance principles, and I think the basic health insurance principle is that people sign up with a health plan, and it's the health plan's responsibility to provide the services that they need. The members, in my mind, belong to the health plan as long as the health plan can provide the services that's necessary. This allows a medical group to essentially whipsaw a health plan by asserting that they own the members, and we heard that in testimony, and that if they can't reach a negotiation with health plan A, then they can sign up with health plan B and take their members with them. This puts it into state law and policy for the Oregon Health Plan, but it seems to me it's the same argument we'll hear next on the health insurance side. And I think it's a bad principle. I thought it was a bad principle in dealing with the Care Oregon family care plan. I thought Care Oregon should have been given the opportunity to make sure they provided services under the contract they had with the state. And as long as they were able to deliver those services, they should have been entitled to deliver them. Instead, the state interceded on behalf of it and moves patients unilaterally from Care Oregon to family care, and that's nothing to stop now to get somebody from family care, or maybe the same group next year saying, okay, we've jacked up family care enough, now let's go back to Care Oregon, get a better contract from them, and move them back again. I mean, it just seems to me that this provides a pretty bad precedent, and I didn't think it made sense when it happened before, and I don't think it makes sense to put the public policy into law. So, let me know.
Thank you. Representative Cannon.
Mr. Chair, it's a question, particularly for you, Representative Greenlick, Representative Hoyle, those who are working most on the transformation proposal have worked on it. How does this relate to, how is this consistent with or not consistent with, the way you've described it to me sounds rather inconsistent with the notion that we're taking towards our Oregon Health Plan population via transformation?
Seems to me the same thing. I mean, I think this puts in place the exact same circumstance under transformation. There's, you can have CCOs, you can have multiple CCOs in an area. And if you had multiple CCOs in an area, CCOA could have worked out a plan with a large group practice, and the large group practice says, oh, I can make more money next year going over to CCOB, and then make under, it seems to me, under the transformation, under this model, you'd have to move those patients that have been assigned to CCOA over to CCOB because they went with the plan. I mean, they went with a group of docs. And I mean, this is exactly, it seems to me, what opens up under the transformation.
Any further discussion? Are we ready for the question?
You have the motion.
You have the motion. Please call the roll.
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Boyle.
Aye.
Representative
Widener. Aye.
Aye.
Co-Vice
Chair
Kennemer.
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
No.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye. Motion passes. I suppose we will not ask Representative Greenlee to carry this on the floor.
I appreciate the feedback. I may comment.
Yeah.
I'll carry it.
He would explain it quite well, though.
Representative Dougherty will carry the bill on the floor. Thank you very much. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 201, and if there is no further excitement to be had,
can I just remind the committee?
Certainly can.
We're meeting Friday morning from 10 to noon.
We're also meeting Wednesday.
Well, right, but that's our usual time and place. Yeah. But I do want to let you folks know that we have shifted our time on Friday to before lunch.
From 10 to noon.
Because the leadership asked us to move all committees before noon on Friday as a part of the Memorial Day break.
Oh.
I'm sorry. As a part of going into our legislative districts on Monday.
If you manage your time well, you have Friday afternoon
have
to work in your office.
We put on with the governor, so I won't
or else.
Which have been, we have the ladies at the legislature, who's been on the calendar for a month, and we've got a group, large group of people coming, and the governor's our speaker. I will not be at health care committee.
That'd be fine.
Sure.
I don't think we have a lot of hot items on.
As long as Representative Greenlick and
me,
Representative Thompson and Representative Hoyle are here, I think that would be plenty to run this committee.
And everybody else, too, because we love each other all the time.
I don't know.
And Representative Thompson will have the gavel, so he'll have things under control. things won't get away.
We better take a roll of who's going to be here and who's not. That may be the opportunity, you know?
Oh, that's right.
Okay,
can we reschedule bills based on who's coming?
I think we could.
It's all in a carryover, though, Mr. Chair.
No quorum.
See what the limits of power are.
You still need 5 votes. Darn.
Oh, darn. With that, I will close the May 23rd, 2011 meeting of the House Committee on Health Care and bid you all have a good afternoon.